I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. After months of stay-at-home orders, limited social contact, kids stuck at home without school or camp or access to friends, work disrupted, and travel plans dashed, it's no wonder that so many of us are feeling overwhelmed, stressed, worried, and bored to tears. The pandemic has made our life so much more restricted. It's no wonder that many are having a hard time knowing how to fill the day, how to break out of the monotony and keep occupied with activities that bring meaning and enjoyment to life. And while some can manage their boredom very well, for others it can lead to harmful behaviors, things like overeating or drinking too much, getting depressed. Researchers say that recognizing the signs of boredom and learning what to do in response are important life skills that can make us healthier, happier, and more productive. So today on Radio Times, how to harness our boredom and make it work for us. And we have two guests who have joined us. James Dankert is a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Waterloo. He's a cognitive neuroscientist, also co-author of a new book with John Eastman called Out of My Skull, The Psychology of Boredom. James Dankert, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be here.
Also with us is Erin Westgate. She's an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Florida, where she studies boredom, interest, and why some thoughts are more engaging than others. Erin Westgate, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, you can always join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. You are two people who study boredom, and I'll start with you, Erin Westgate. What makes boredom so interesting?
You know, I think one of the funny things when studying boredom is the fear that you're going to say something really boring about it. And, you know, to be honest, that's what I thought when I first started it. Like, oh, my God, why would you study boredom? No one grows up saying, I want to be a boredom researcher. But the more you look into it, the more you realize that boredom answers really fundamental questions. Are we doing things that matter to us? Are we doing things that are meaningful to us? Is there something wrong? Do we need to find other ways of engaging in our life? So boredom is this sort of emotional signal about these things that really, really matter. It really gets at the central questions. And I personally find it fascinating that for such an important experience that we all have at times, that psychology and science is only just now really starting to look at it and get a handle on what this thing is and why we get bored.
Well, it's interesting, James Dankert, picking up on that, is that philosophers have had such a longstanding interest in boredom, and it seems it's relatively new to psychology. What is your interest in boredom?
Well, I'd agree with Erin that it's a ubiquitous experience. We all experience it, and yet we've sort of trivialized it. We don't give it the due that it deserves. And so I find boredom interesting for the same reasons that Erin said. You know, it is this signal that tells us that we need to be doing something different than whatever we're doing now, something that matters more to us. And I also think that in some of the work we've done with people who've suffered from traumatic brain injuries, it can become a fairly serious problem for certain groups of people. And so for those individuals that suffer certain kinds of brain injuries or suffer with the mental health issues like depression and anxiety, boredom can become a significant component of their struggles. And so it's not a trivial experience. It's an important signal. And it's one that we, as Erin suggested, we really need to understand more.
I was reading, James, a bit about you, and there's some personal reasons for your interest in boredom. You have a brother who had sounds like a pretty terrible car accident a number of years ago and had some traumatic brain injury. And one of his responses, I guess, or one of his descriptions about, I guess, what life was like for him was feeling more bored than he was before he had the accident. Can you explain that?
That's right. My brother, when I was about 19 and he was 20 or so, had a fairly serious motor vehicle crash, and he suffered a serious brain injury as a consequence of that. Now, he recovered and he got to the point that he was able to maintain employment and live independently. But had other sorts of struggles that were sort of hidden and silent that were not easy for others to see. And one of those was boredom. Hmm. Things that he used to enjoy before his brain injury just weren't doing it for him after the brain injury. And he told me about that, and this was long before I had trained as a clinical neuropsychologist. But once I got that training under my belt, I saw between about 15 and 20 young men, and it was always young men, who'd suffered similar brain injuries. And I would ask these people, you know, do you feel more bored now than you did before your brain injury? And to a number, they would say yes, but they didn't just say yes. They almost leapt out of their chairs to say yes, because this was something that was important to them, and it was the first time anybody had given it any airtime. And so to me, that suggested that something organic has happened, something has changed in the brain, some threshold for experiencing things as pleasurable, enjoyable or meaningful has been reset by their brain injury. And in part, that was what really got me into researching boredom and trying to understand what the neural states or the brain states associated with boredom are.
Well, to you, Aaron, then how do you see boredom? And I'm curious about whether you see it differently from James.
Yeah, I think one of the really fun parts about studying something like this that we haven't really looked at in psychology is that we're still getting a sense of what exactly even boredom is. So I think me and James have a couple differences, but I think we would both agree that boredom is an important signal that what you're doing right now isn't working. I tend to argue that boredom comes from feelings that you're either not able to engage in what you're doing, that there's these attentional problems, and there's a long, long, long history of work in research on boredom finding that when you have trouble paying attention, that increases how bored you're going to feel. But I also think that that's separate from feeling that what you're, you know, I can pay attention, but I'm not, what I'm paying attention to doesn't feel meaningful to me. I sometimes say this is like being in like a boring talk, or God forbid, listening to a boring radio.
Oh dear, don't say that, Aaron.
I know, blasphemy.
Please.
And you're like, I can't.
It's a death there.
I just don't, that would never happen to these
listeners.
Of course
not.
But like, if you just don't care, even if you can attend to it, and even if you care, you know, I understand what's going on, but it doesn't have meaning or value or relevance to me, that can also be a route to boredom. So there's these sort of two ways to end up at being bored, that what you're doing isn't meaningful, or that you just can't do it in the first place because you can't maintain attention on it. But what both of those signal is that you're not meaningfully engaged in what you're doing. And boredom, as I see boredom as emotion, and what boredom signals, like all emotions, is that, you know, this is a problem. You're not meaningfully engaged. And as James mentioned earlier, it's a signal that you need to change something. You either need to find a way to find what you're doing is meaningful, or find a way to be able to engage with it. And for people like James was talking about with traumatic brain injuries, or my grandfather, for instance, had Alzheimer's. When people have these kinds of issues, they may not be able to modulate attention and meaning in these ways that other people can, and that can make boredom a real problem.
I don't want to spend the whole hour defining boredom. As fascinating, though, as it is, let me go back to you, James, only because it's the more you think about it, the more I think it does need some kind of description. But as you have to, as my understanding about how you see boredom is it's not about apathy. It's not about that you don't care. It's actually that you do care, but you're somehow stuck.
Absolutely. Apathy, by its definition, is you don't care about what's going on around you at this given point, whereas boredom is a motivational state. Boredom feels uncomfortable precisely because it represents a kind of conundrum. We feel this signal that is telling us that we need to do something to become engaged, as Aaron said. But for whatever reason, we're failing to respond well to that signal. So we've talked about this before, as a failure to launch. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can see that you're sort of between a rock and a hard place in some sense. You recognize very acutely that signal and that need to be engaged. I love the quote from Leo Tolstoy, which defines boredom as the desire for desires. So you feel that desire to want something. But you don't want whatever currently in front of you right now. You don't want any of those options. And so you fail to sort of launch into something that matters most. The other example that I think works for people and for many of your listeners would be anybody who's out there as a parent would have that experience of their child coming to them and saying, I'm bored. And what they're really saying is, I'm bored and I want you to fix it for me. And so as a dutiful parent, we trot out all of these different options that the child could do, you know, go ride your bike, go and play basketball, go play with your Legos, whatever it is. And at every turn, the child dismisses those options. And the thing that's interesting about that to me is that the options we give them to fix their boredom are things we know have worked for them in the past. So it's not as though they never enjoy those activities. What they're saying is, I don't want to do that right now, and I don't know what I want to do. And so, yeah, it's not apathy. It is a highly motivated state and feels uncomfortable because we're failing to satisfy that state, that desire for desires, as Tolstoy puts it.
Well, and I love that Tolstoy description of boredom. Aaron, I'm wondering, though, and I began by talking about the pandemic and how so many of us are living these much more constricted lives. We don't have the same kind of access to the outside world, to our social networks, to work, to, you know, the things that I think make life meaningful. So does boredom seem like a natural response to the way our lives are right now?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think a lot of us, not everyone, but a lot of people are feeling bored right now. And we've sort of lost a lot of the routine and structure that provides meaning to our everyday lives, as well as like a lot of the activities. You know, we have some data actually on this, looking at boredom in almost 60,000 people around the world. And what strikes me the most is, like, yes, people are bored, but what really is striking is how variable it is, that the situation really matters, that some people are experiencing a lot more boredom than others. College students who are stuck at home from their campuses, for instance, in March, April, were significantly more bored than others. So the situation matters a lot, but also people prefer perceptions of that situation. Some people have sort of used this time as a wonderful sort of retreat, you know, to go and bake bread and call up friends and family they haven't gotten to talk too much before. And the data we're seeing suggests that those people probably aren't bored, that they are doing all the right things. They found meaningful ways to engage, and they're not, as James put it, wanting something but not knowing what to want or how to engage in it. They have found good solutions to this new free time, and other people haven't. So there's a lot of variability right now in who is bored, what situations are making people bored, and how people's own individual perceptions of whether these, this, you know, free time, for instance, is a good thing or a bad thing. So there's just a huge amount of variability right now in who is bored and why.
Well, I do want to talk more about boredom, but first we have to take a very short break. And I have to say, as someone who hosts a radio show, boredom is the thing I fear the most. Boredom and a bad guest. So we are talking about boredom today on Radio Times. And the fact that I think so many of us are feeling as if our lives are so much more constricted now and are struggling, frankly, with boredom. And I'm talking with Aaron Westgate. She's an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Florida. James Dankert is a cognitive neuroscientist, co-author of a book called Out of My Skull, The Psychology of Boredom. And you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wang talking with Aaron Westgate and James Dankert about boredom, something that they have spent a fair number of years studying. James, I'd like to go back to you. You mentioned, a child going to their parents and saying, I'm bored, and the parent trying to come up with a list of things that they can do to get unbored. But I remember being told as a kid, telling my parents that I was bored, being told, well, that means you're boring. I mean, which was painful, I have to say, to hear that, but somehow that it's a personality defect. Can you speak to that?
We can come back to what Erin was saying about the data that she collected, which I'm excited to hear more about at some point. But, there's a lot of variability in how people experience bored, whether or not they experience it often and whether or not they experience it at all. And so we do have that popular phrase that people love to say of, you know, only boring people get
right.
bored.
Right.
What I think is happening when people say that is that If I think, you know, only boring people get bored, then when I get that boredom signal, I just respond rapidly and effectively to it. And that's true of some people, that, you know, when they get the signal that says whatever you're doing now isn't meaningful, it's not really satisfying you in some important way, they just switch and do something completely different or do something that sort of works for them. My 15-year-old son did that the other day. He just got out of the house and went for a bike ride. I asked him when he returned, you know, why'd you go for the bike ride? He said, because I was bored. And I said, well, you told me you never get bored. He says, Dad, I get bored all the time. I just do something about it quickly. And so I think that's what happens when people claim that only boring people get bored. But then, as Aaron pointed out, with that variability across the population, some of us just aren't as easily able to respond to that signal and switch gears and do something different. So I don't think it's a personality flaw or a personality defect, but I do think that there are going to be personality differences that are important in determining whether or not you're a person who suffers from boredom or not. Some of those are the extent to which you can exert self-control. So how well are you able to sort of marshal your own thoughts and your own emotions in the pursuit of goals? People who can do that well tend to experience boredom less, but those of us who struggle with self-control might tend to experience boredom a little more.
Aaron, let me go back to you, and I'm interested in this connection between boredom and attention. And I was wondering whether, you know, people that are prone to boredom, whether they need more stimulation, whether they have more attention deficit disorder, for lack of a better word, or whether there's that kind of search for stimulation that other people don't seem to need as much. Can you speak to that?
Well, there's a long line of work showing that, like, when we're not able to pay attention to something, we feel bored. And there's a couple ways and reasons why you might have trouble paying attention. One is that there's just not enough going on, right? And that's that classic, like, oh, I need more stimulation. And this, you know, really slow subtitled movie isn't giving it to me. And I need more to pay attention, and I can't. And there is research linking of the need for more stimulation for sensation seeking to having a greater likelihood of experiencing boredom. And that makes sense, right? If you need more stimulation sort of chronically and you're not getting it, that's one reason why you might feel boredom more often. But there's sort of newer work also showing that we can sometimes have trouble paying attention because what you're doing is too hard. I always like to use the example of being in a math class and you have a student, for instance, that goes, you know, math is boring. I don't like it. Sometimes I think that that's really more an indication that you're not able to pay attention, not because math is too easy and it's not stimulating enough, but because you start to try to engage, it becomes really hard to do that. You can't pay attention. It doesn't make sense. And you end up not engaging and feeling bored, not because it was too easy and understimulating, but because it was too hard and overstimulating. And I think we don't often think about boredom as being caused in those kinds of situations, and they can catch us by surprise when they do. So I always talk about how there's this sort of Goldilocks sweet spot that you really want to do things that are just hard enough to be challenging, but not too hard that they become difficult to engage in. So if you've heard of flow, for instance, Csikszentmihalyi's classic conception of flow, it's those sort of sweet spot moments where you're optimally challenged, it's really meaningful, and you just kind of get lost in it, you know, lost in the flow of the game if you're playing sports, or for writers, sometimes you enter a sort of writing trance where you just, like, you know, come out of it hours later and like, oh my goodness, like, it was just perfect, it's so effortless. And as James was saying, some people are going to be better at dialing in on the kinds of activities that offer that kind of optimal challenge for them than other people are.
Aaron, we're going to try to get you on a better phone, so we will take care of that and get you back on the air. Let me turn to you, James, and actually a comment from Richard, who asks, any studies indicating that boredom has increased in recent years due to contemporary need for continuous stimuli? James?
It's really hard to answer that question because what you need is to be able to take measures of boredom over a number of years in the same sort of populations and you know, we just don't have that kind of data. And it's a popular thing to want to say, you know, we've got these sort of technological things like our smartphones and the internet, our fingertips, and perhaps boredom is on the increase because there's sort of too much information around. But there is at least one study that looked at teenagers and high school students in America that did show from grades 9 to 12, so around that sort of 14, 15 years of age to 17 or 18, that there seemed to be a rise in boredom experienced in that group. We'd need a lot more data to say something sort of really definitive about it, but it's certainly possible that, and I return to something that Erin was saying, that, you know, sometimes we see boredom at the extremes, when things are really under-challenging and when things are really over-challenging. And if we think about our current times, there's just this sort of influx of information. There's a constant barrage of information, and that can be really hard to make sense of. You know, there's so much different stuff on the internet that we could be paying attention to. There's all the social media that we could be paying attention to. And with that sort of onslaught of information, it can be very difficult to sort of deal with that and cope with that. And that's one of those sort of situations Erin was describing, where there's sort of too much stimulation to for us to make sense of it. And I think it's entirely possible that in this era we're experiencing more boredom because of that. And then there is work also showing that our relationship to our phones and our relationship to social media is sometimes informed by boredom. So there's some sense in which we turn to our social media or we turn to the internet as a pacifier for boredom. And John Alhai at the University of Toledo has done a bunch of this sort of work showing that boredom is sometimes higher in people who show what amount to addictive behaviours in response to the use of their phones and the use of social media. I hope that answers Richard's question.
Yeah, I think it does. I appreciate that. I was thinking, Erin was talking about flow, that feeling of timelessness when you're somehow in sync with the world or with another person or with your work or whatever. And it is interesting to think about what happens to time in boredom, how, I mean, it does feel as if time has slowed down. You're waiting at the DMV. This is back in the olden days before the pandemic, you know, and you can see the line stretching out in front of you and you just know, I'm going to be here for hours. And it feels like days, right?
Yeah, and there certainly is research, some of it coming from our lab early on, showing that time really does drag on when you're bored. The interesting thing about flow, which is I would describe flow as an extreme form of engagement. So the state of flow, you know, is one in which you're so keyed in to what you're doing that the rest of the world just seems to drift away. And in that state, one of two things can happen to time. Time can either feel like lots of it has passed in an instant. So you might be doing this activity, you might be concentrating on something for hours, but when you get out of it, you thought you were only doing it for a minute. Yeah. Or time can sort of drag on and slow down. It doesn't really drag on in flow. It slows down and still feels okay. The important thing about flow and time is that it still feels pleasurable. It still feels enjoyable. Whereas in boredom, there's only one direction that time goes. It slows down, it drags, and it feels very unpleasant.
And let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's James Dankert. He's a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Waterloo in Canada. He's a cognitive neuroscientist, co-author of a new book called Out of My Skull, The Psychology of Boredom. Erin Westgate is with us as well. She's an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Florida. She studies boredom and interests and why some thoughts are more engaging than others. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Erin, we've got you back, and I'm told it's a better phone line, so that's good. Help us understand, I guess, the connection between boredom and potentially destructive behaviors, whether eating too much or drinking too much or using dangerous drugs or even depression, what the signs are, how boredom can lead to something as serious as that.
Well, you know, James was talking earlier about how, because the example of his son, there, some people are really good at responding to boredom in good ways. When everything's going right, when you feel bored, you react by doing things that make you less bored. And hopefully those are things like going for a bike ride or things that are meaningful and adaptive and good, but sometimes people can respond in less adaptive ways, partially when they don't have really very many good options. So there is work showing that boredom, for instance, can lead to pro-social behavior, We also see the opposite, that sometimes boredom, especially chronic boredom, especially in situations where people have sort of limited choices in how to respond or limited ability in responding well, that boredom is linked to things like substance use, to alcohol use, to drinking. We also have, this is really new research, just was accepted recently, finding that boredom, when you experimentally induce boredom in the lab, you can actually get people to engage in a lot of really antisocial behaviors. Wow. So if we make people bored, they are more likely to grind up little harmless bugs, for instance. The bugs aren't really harmed, but people think they're grinding them up in a coffee grinder. They're more likely to just dock other people's pay for fun for no real reason.
Wow.
Like, for instance, he said, James over there is getting $100 for being on the show today. If you want, you can just like press a button and take $10 away from him for each time you press it. We find that making people bored makes them more likely to press that button. So there are times when boredom leads to bad behavior, quote unquote, but that doesn't mean that boredom is bad. It's really, boredom is giving us this information that we're not meaningfully engaged. It's what you do with that information that matters. I sometimes use the analogy of pain, because pain isn't pleasant, like boredom isn't pleasant, but it's giving you really important information, and there's healthy adaptive ways to react to pain, whether that's physical pain or sort of mental pain like boredom. You can treat the problem that caused it. You know, you can go to the doctor and get, you know, that bone fixed, or you can do things that make the pain go away for a little while, but aren't really solving the problem. So drinking to make physical or mental pain go away is not a good solution, but it suppresses those bad feelings for a little while. And so it works, but it works in an unsustainable way that doesn't end up solving the problem in the long run. So boredom isn't sort of bad, but it depends on how we respond.
Right, right. Boredom is boredom, and it's how we deal with it. James, you have an interesting story in your book about looking at two astronauts and how they coped with being in outer space. One obviously doing better than the other, dealing with the boredom of being out there.
Yeah, I found those stories interesting in part because for those of us who are not lucky enough to go to space, we imagine that doing so would be just a great adventure. So how could you ever be bored going into space? And I had the opportunity to talk with Chris Hadfield, who is a Canadian astronaut who was heading up the International Space Station for a number of years and became a little bit famous on the Twitterverse for doing various things. And Chris is one of these people who would say only boring people get bored. But when you probe and talk with him for a little bit longer, you find out that he does get bored. He just is one of these people who responds really rapidly to it. And he told a story about growing up on a farm in southwestern Ontario, and he would enjoy plowing the fields because you would take the tractor out. In front of you was an unplowed field. Behind you was a plowed field. So you could see great progress in what you were doing. And you could feel a sense of achievement that you'd done that. And then Chris introduced me to a term I'd never heard before that was called harrowing. So apparently harrowing is going out into the field with your tractor and breaking up big chunks of mud into smaller chunks of mud. So in front of you is just a vast brown expanse. And behind you is a vast brown expanse. You can't really see much of your progress, and so you don't feel like you're achieving anything. And Chris said that was boring. He found that harrowing was a very boring kind of thing to do. And so when he did that, he would engage his brain doing something else. So while he was driving the heavy machinery of a tractor, he would test himself and challenge himself to see how long he could hold his breath. Probably not the best idea when you're driving around in a large tractor. But what Chris was saying is that in those moments when he gets bored, he just finds some other thing to do to occupy his mind. And then he put me onto a book by a Russian cosmonaut, Lebedev Valentin, who wrote a book called 212 Days in Space. He too had spent time on the International Space Station, and he talked about experiencing boredom. There was a delivery that came to the space station, and he was looking forward to that because it was going to have a video camera, and finally he'd have something to do during the boring moments. And what that really sort of said to me when you put those two stories side by side is something that Aaron's already touched on a number of times, that there is a lot of variability in how humans deal with being bored. And some people really struggle to respond well to that signal. even those people who we think are having, you know, one of the greatest adventures that we could imagine, going to outer space, some of them might not have the personal makeup to deal well with downtimes. And then there's one other thing I think Aaron mentioned, talking about the loss of routines in the pandemic. And that sort of feels a little bit counterintuitive, you know, that routine sounds like a sort of monotonous, kind of boring thing. Why would we want our routines back? But I think it's really important that we have routines, because it makes our day somewhat predictable and allows us to sort of know what's coming next. But it can get to a point where routines might induce boredom. And when you think about the astronauts, I was surprised to learn that their day is structured down to 5-minute intervals by NASA. So that's a fairly extreme routine. And perhaps for some people, that's great. It really structures their day for them and makes it easy to cope with. And for some people, perhaps it's boring.
Well, you know, Aaron, we're about a minute away from our break here, but you talk about that sort of that Goldilocks, you know, not too hot, not too cold. But I wonder, picking up on what James said about routine and novelty, sort of finding that Goldilocks feeling between what is predictable and what is new.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really interesting. And as James points out, just like it is with routine, the same person can see something new and novel, and one person can find it interesting and one person can find it completely boring, because whether you find novelty interesting depends in part on whether you can make sense of it. So, for instance, there's some work showing that if you read this like really abstract modern poetry and you have no idea what it's about, even though it's novel and new, you're going to be bored by it because you can't make any sense of it. But if you clue people in, like, by the way, this poem is about, in this case, killer sharks, people do find it interesting. So it's not just newness or routine. It's, like James is saying, how people make sense of that routine and how they interpret that novelty. We really want a balance where it's not so routine that you feel trapped and, like, you know, everything makes sense and you're just doing it all for the 10,000th time.
Hold on to that thought, only because, yeah, we're up against a break here. And we're talking about boredom, what it is, what it isn't, and how to deal with it. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're talking about boredom in this hour of the show, and we wanted to do this program because we figured, with so many of us living under the pandemic and having so much of our lives constricted, boredom is an after effect of something like that, or it certainly can be. We're talking about how to harness our boredom and make it work for us. And again, our guests are James Dankert, a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Waterloo. He's a cognitive neuroscientist. He's also co-author with John Eastman of a brand new book called Out of My Skull, The Psychology of Boredom. Aaron Westgate is an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Florida, where she studies boredom, interest, and why some thoughts are more engaging than others. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a couple of comments. One from Kate. She says, the best way to fight boredom is to do something for someone else. A question from Jean in Mount Holly. Have either of your guests spoken to people who have been in solitary confinement? That's a great question. And James, can I toss that to you? Have you looked at people and how they have coped with solitary confinement?
I have not personally talked with people who have experienced solitary confinement. We certainly looked at this when we were putting together the book, and boredom will be a problem when you put people in a room where they have nothing to do. And sometimes we do such inhumane things as, you know, 23 hours of light. That's an abnormal circumstance for any human to be in. And we can relate this to experiments from the 1950s in sensory deprivation, where we put people in certain circumstances where they really had no sensory feedback from their external world. Eventually, people start to do things like hallucinate. You know, they start to see things and hear things that are not there. And what that tells me is that the brain needs to have an interface with the world. We need to interact with the world. And if we bring that back to the pandemic, you know, this is one of the things that we're missing. Perhaps we can have all the Zoom meetings in the world, and we might even do more Zoom meetings with our friends and relatives than we would have done actual meetings before the pandemic. But what we really crave and what we really need is that sort of physical contact and interaction. And so when you put people in a place where they can't get that in solitary confinement, boredom is going to become a problem. We also know that it gets worse than that, right? So there are a couple of cases in the Canadian experience of individuals who had extraordinary amounts of time in solitary confinement. Adam Capay is one of the stories that we tell in the book, an Indigenous man that spent more than a year in solitary confinement, which is just inhumane. And this will lead to a sort of disconnect with reality and a disconnect with the world that is just not healthy. So it gets worse than just experiencing boredom, but certainly boredom in solitary confinement is going to be a problem.
Cliff picks up on something, Aaron, that you say. It seems like some people overcompensate for being easily bored by engaging in extreme or dangerous behavior. I know I get tempted to do inadvisable behavior just to kill the boredom. And you were speaking to that. Aaron, let me ask you just a really very basic question, which is how do you deal with boredom at work or boredom with one's job?
There's actually an entire line of work looking at workplace boredom that really finds that one of the things people talk about a lot is this Goldilocks problem, that things are too easy or too hard. So, for instance, you see a lot of interest enhancement activities, what we call it, where when people don't have enough to do at work, they kind of find things for themselves to do, or they find new ways to challenge themselves. Like James was telling the story about the guy on the tractor holding his breath for different periods to make harrowing less boring. People engage in similar strategies at work as well, that they give themselves little challenges. There's a really interesting study in car driving, so driving on highways for long periods of time is boring, where when you give drivers little like speed challenges and little challenges to do, that they do them and it makes them less bored. And that's something that I think you see a lot in the workplace, is people trying to find ways to sort of jazz up what they're doing, find little challenges to challenge themselves with. It's a harder problem when there's too much going on. Depending on people's role in an organization, it may be very difficult to dial down too much difficulty if that's what's leading to boredom instead. But finding little challenges, finding ways to rethink about how important it is. Like the case with the astronaut, it does seem wild that someone in space could be bored. And one way you can react to that is by reminding yourself of how amazing and incredible it actually is. So really reframing the value of what you're doing. It's difficult, but to the extent people can do that, they're less likely to be bored at work as well.
James, let me ask you about daydreaming and boredom and how that can lead to creativity.
There's at least one study from Sandy Mann in the UK that shows that if you make people bored, and what she did is she had people write out phone numbers from a telephone book. If you make people bored and then you test them on a test of creativity, it's a fairly simple test, this one. You show people a common everyday object and you ask them to list how many possible uses of that object they could come up with. So you show them a polystyrene cup, and of course our first use is to say, well, you can drink from it, but what other uses can you think of? And the more uses you come up with for that particular object, the more creative you're said to be. And in Sandy's study, what she found was that she was successful in making people bored, but then she found that some people, when they were bored, engaged in daydreaming. And it was that subset of people, the people who engaged in daydreaming, who did better on the creative task that she used. You know, how many uses of the cup can you come up with? It's a really tricky thing to talk about. I think a lot of people want to say boredom can make you creative, and I would really argue strongly against that. Boredom, as I think Aaron pointed out, the signal of boredom is neither good nor bad. It's about how we choose to respond to it. And creativity is a really complex and challenging aspect of human behavior for us to understand. So for those people who have cultivated creative outlets, whether that's music or art or writing or sculpture, whatever it is, if you have spent some period of time in your life cultivating that creative outlet, then when you get bored, you're going to be able to turn to that creative outlet and quite successfully deal with being bored. Now, you asked initially about daydreaming. We can all do that. And daydreaming is probably a positive way to deal with being bored in the moment if you have no other sorts of options. We know that when people get bored, they tend to mind wander more. But there's different kinds of mind wandering. Daydreaming itself is a kind of mind wandering. But there are other kinds of mind wandering that don't feel good and that don't promote a sort of positive response to boredom. So it's complex, but daydreaming can be quite a good response to being bored.
Can you speak about daydreaming, Erin?
Yes, I think like James was saying, people do daydream when they're bored. It tends not to be what we find in research is when we ping people throughout the day and ask them what they're thinking about. People do report that daydreaming is like mildly positive, but they don't find it as enjoyable as doing other external things. It's almost always more enjoyable to read a book or watch a television show or do something on your own that sort of engage with the world rather than retreating to your own mind. But daydreaming can be positive. It's hard to do intentionally. When we ask people to do it in the lab, they report it's like, it's all right. It's sort of about as enjoyable as brushing your teeth, which is like, you know, it's not torture, but no one's like, man, I'm going to go brush my teeth for fun now. I agree with James. If that's all, you know, you're stuck in traffic and you're sitting at a red light and you're bored, it's probably better to daydream than to pull out your cell phone, right? A better response. But there's probably other more enjoyable, more adaptive things that you could be doing.
Let me get a caller to join our conversation. This is Dutch, and he's calling us from Philadelphia. Dutch, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, great discussion. I love the discussion on solitary confinement. I'd like to go one step further. Is this a teaching moment for all of us to empathize with those in the facilities, almost a million right now or more, that have now been had their education, recreation, and so forth taken away, while we have iPads and smartphones and Zoom conferences, they now have nothing. What can we as the citizenry of the U.S. learn from this moment?
And you're talking about this, are you talking about this moment in terms of understanding our own boredom?
Our own isolation. Imagine these individuals who are locked up 23 hours a day, if not 24, because of coronavirus. And they have no educational services. They've been limited tremendously. How can we empathize to move past this point to help those in incarceration and get them education, Zoom conferences, classes, and so on? We see that now it can be done.
Well, Dutch, I appreciate the call. It's a little off topic, but it picks up on what we were talking about earlier about solitary confinement. Erin, anything you want to say back to Dutch?
I do think it helps give people some perspective. We know that when people can empathize with what it's like to be in a position that it can increase sort of willingness to do something about it. And in that case, like I really hesitate to say that being bored in quarantine at home is like being in solitary confinement, but it does maybe give some people a little bit more insight into, you know, if I feel this bored in this circumstances, which is really actually pretty well off, maybe it might lead some people to care and have a little more empathy.
James, and to you, Erin, as well, oftentimes, you know, research is called me-search because it's really people trying to understand their own selves. For you, James, are you someone who gets bored? Do you struggle with boredom?
Yeah, there's a really strong component for me about physician heal thyself in my research. I experience boredom. I have all my life. I am a little bit better at dealing with it now in my late 40s than I was in my early 20s. But I do experience it a lot, and I hate the experience. And so in some sense, I do the research that I do as a means of trying to understand it better. I did think when I first started boredom research that perhaps that understanding would help me overcome it. And I think now that that's wrong. I think that boredom is this signal, as we've talked about throughout the hour. And as such, it serves a purpose. It has a function in our lives. So I don't want to overcome boredom anymore. I just want to learn to live better with it. And that is to find better outlets, better responses, better behaviors to engage. when I get that boredom signal. And, you know, it's an ongoing project.
And for you, Erin?
I wouldn't say I get bored a lot, but I would agree with James that I always say that one of my favorite emotions to experience is interest, that feeling of being totally fascinated and wrapped up with something. And one of my least favorites is in many ways the opposite, feeling bored. I would much rather be really sad or really angry than just feel like you're not engaged at all. And working on boredom has, I think, as James suggests, helped me think about how to deal with those moments when I feel bored and identify why I feel that way and what I can do about it.
And is that's the kind of the message to all of us, which is not to chase it away or ignore it, but to say, well, what is the message? If I'm bored, what is the message to me, Erin?
Exactly. Exactly.
So, James, doing this research, sort of as your son dealt with his own boredom by hopping on his bike and taking a ride, you have more tools that you can use when you're feeling bored?
The primary thing, I'm not sure if I would say I have more tools, but the primary thing that I think I'm getting better at as time goes on, Marty, is that I just take a deep breath first and foremost. So boredom is an uncomfortable feeling. It is associated with feeling agitated and restless. Those feelings of agitation and restlessness, I think, are the thing that try to push us to outrun it and get away from it as quickly as we can, which can be also the thing that pushes us to these maladaptive responses, you know, engaging in overeating and drinking too much and so on. So the thing I'm doing much better now than I was two decades ago is that when I feel bored, I pause and reflect and think about, well, why am I bored right now and what could I do that would be more engaging? As Erin suggests, you know, the flip side of boredom is not one thing, but a lot of things, curiosity, interest, these kinds of things that I think are also really important for us to foster.
Well, and picking up on that, and Erin, we're almost out of time here, but one of the things that I read that you were offering us as a kind of suggestion, which is to seek out those things that are interesting over the ones that are easily enjoyable, that the interesting stuff is the stuff that will help us deal with some of our boredom.
Yeah, the thing about interest, and one of the things I really enjoy about it, is in some ways it's a risk. You know, watch it, going in to see some new movie that's in a different language, that you have to pay attention to the subtitles. It's new, it's challenging, it might not make sense, you might find it boring, but if you can engage in it, you can find it interesting. It sort of gives you a new insight, it changes your perspective, it sort of sets you up to find similar experiences interesting again down the road. And that doesn't mean that the enjoyable option is always bad. It really depends on the situation that, you know, if you come home, you're exhausted, you have kids you need to watch, like, go put on that guilty pleasure TV show. But when you have the resources, choosing to do interesting things can sort of build up your capacity and your repertoire of things that you can do in the future when you get bored again. And having a big repertoire on hand, I think, is really key, because it lets you dial in to why you're bored in the moment.
Well, we got to leave it there. Erin Westgate and James Dankert, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times talking about boredom. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out more about the program. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Kelsey Hansen produce it. This is Iggy Pop. I'm Bored, from his 1979 album, New Values.
I'm bored. I'm the chairman of the board. I'm a lengthy monologue. I'm living like a dog. I'm bored. I bore myself to sleep at night. I bore myself in broad daylight.